What's up, people? Welcome back to Rebranding Safety. This week's part two of our interview with Dr. Darren Blumenthal from America, talking all about how to get innovation and change in your business. Let's get into the pod.
Health and safety is almost a victim of its own success.
Weird and oppressive regime of health and safety regulations.
A huge fire engulfs a tower block in London.
Children being forced to wear goggles to play conkers at school.
Worst oil field disaster, 164 dead.
Rebranding Safety, the modern health and safety podcast, crushing the stereotype. Brought to you by Risk Fluent and your host, James McPherson. Welcome back to Rebranding Safety, everybody. Rebranding Safety does exactly what it says on the tin. We're here by podcast and YouTube to challenge the perceptions, to challenge those health and safety gone mad practices, to provide you with really good conversations on this podcast and some simple advice free for everybody to use on YouTube. So if you listen here on the podcast, which you obviously are, feel free to go over and check out our YouTube channel. All of our interviews are on there for you to watch. This week we're talking with Dr. Darren Blumenthal. Now this is part two, so if this is the first podcast you've picked up, make sure you go back and listen to part one. We're basically talking all about a framework which Dara created herself a long time ago that seems to have had a little bit of a rise to the populace in social media. It's all about how to create innovation and change in your business. So make sure you go and listen to part one, and we'll get into this one in 1 minute. Let's just do some shout outs. So first things first, we like to give shout outs to people that say nice things about me because it massages my ego. So all three today are from LinkedIn. First, we have Simon Archer drop me a message on LinkedIn. Said he'd been listening to the podcast, wanted to reach out, likes what we're doing. He works in construction. He's wondering if we have any plans to do a CDM podcast. The answer is yes, Simon, we do. We have a podcast episode recorded. I just need to pull my finger out and edit it. And that was with our good friend Rachel, who's been on the podcast before, and she's very popular. So we'll look forward to that. That'll be out in the coming weeks. So keep your ears and eyes out on social media and the podcast, etc. And that will be out soon, Simon. Up next, we have Roy Lovelock. Let me just get his message up. Here it is. Me and Roy had quite a long conversation, so I won't read it out. I'll just read the initial message out. So he connected me on LinkedIn as well. Said, new listener to your podcast. Loving the messages, brackets, and the swearing, close brackets. Does have its place in training for sure. So it was a very nice message. Very nice to hear that somebody is an advocate of my swearing, because unfortunately, I was a bit on the fence as to whether I should cut it back or not. I do try to cut it back in interviews. I think it doesn't really suit interviews. It's more the podcast where it's just me having a little bit of a rant sitting on my soapbox. So thank you, Roy, and welcome to the community that is Rebranding Safety as. I'm not really sure. I'm still working on a name to call you all. Up next, and last but not least, we have Greg Burgess. Greg connected with me on LinkedIn as well, dropped us a message saying he's been enjoying the podcast whilst on the road, some interesting stuff. So thank you very much, Greg. Thank you for everybody who listens to the podcast. If you're new to the podcast, as you can see from those, you know, it's a good podcast. So subscribe on whatever platform you're listening to. I'd absolutely love it, guys, if you give us a rate and review, whatever platform you're listening on, and share the podcast. You know, let's get other people listening to this. Let's share the wealth. Without further ado, though, let's get into part two of our interview with Dr. Darren Blumenthal, all about how to create innovation and change in your business.
As you kind of explain it, it just kind of makes sense. I just imagine that kind of boardroom, and we as a safety professionals, we would always just be like, well, that's just a bad culture. You know, that's a bad culture. And that's exactly what you were saying at the beginning of this conversation, of just skimming along the surface of this stuff. And actually, oh, that's a bad culture. That's why you're not saying anything in a meeting. And I remember being in a meeting just not too long after Grenfell, and we were, you know, trying to work out whether we've got a problem. And then this gentleman just kept going on, well, that's all, it's all about culture. It's all about culture. And I was like, yeah, but like, do you actually understand what that means? Like, even from my point of view as a non-sociologist, psychologist, whatever, it's a real complex process of loads of different winding roads. And then to get down to your kind of level of sociology, psychology, critical theory, it gets even more complex. And so that's kind of, as you're kind of talking, I'm just imagining that kind of boardroom environment, how much you can probably, maybe it's quite fascinating for you to sit but fly on the wall at the side of a boardroom with your kind of intellect of why people are, and I bet it's quite fascinating to just sit and watch people from your point of view, isn't it?
And I used to do more of that. Now what's more fascinating to me is actually trying to draw people into deeper connection. And something I can add, so on the diagram, I wrote, this is where the conversation usually stops, right? And the real risk there and the challenge that I think we're starting to face is that, like you just said with culture in your example, culture, right, this, you know, this sort of, this word, this signifier actually means a huge amount. It means so much, right? And so it's like things get reduced down, like empathy, right? I'm being empathetic. I'm being empathetic. Can't you tell? Like I'm yelling at you that I'm being empathetic because I'm using the word empathy, right? And so two things. One, as we abstract things, right? We make thing an it. We make it an it or an its, right? We take this really rich, really, I mean, if you start to think about culture, the culture of your workplace as something that is literally experiential. It is something that is in your direct experience. And it isn't just it isn't just a thing out there that you can point to, right? So with psychological safety, one of the things that's happening is that I hear people say, all of a sudden, someone says something, someone else is like, I don't feel safe, you know? And then that gets shut down, right? And I just want to like really underline that like psychological safety means that you feel safe enough to be uncomfortable.
Okay.
You feel safe enough to be uncomfortable. Because the only way that we are able to achieve liberation, the only way that we're to achieve things like innovation, to really open up and go into a deep exploratory place, is that we have to be able to move through our discomfort.
I like that.
We have to move through the uncertainty of the moment. So psychological safety doesn't mean everyone feels safe all the time. It means that we as a collective, we have enough safety, like sort of fundamentally built into our culture, into our we space, into how it feels to be together, that I know if that I get uncomfortable for a couple minutes, I'm going to be okay on the other side.
Yeah. Wow. That's fascinating. That's like creating a safe environment to feel for a short amount of time, potentially unsafe.
Exactly.
That's fascinating. Yeah. Wow. So in a nutshell, that's psychological safety, and you did touch on like interpersonal trust. How does that kind of resonate in a business? What does that actually look like? What does it sound like or feel like?
Yeah, feel like. I like that. So,
because if I had to look at the words, maybe if I try and help
get
to a point, like if I look at the word interpersonal, so like into me, like that. I trust myself, but then interpersonal between me and someone else is having that, what I would normally call trust, as I trust you not to ruin my podcast because you know what you're talking about. Or do you know what I mean? You create that trust and you trust me to not embarrass you on this podcast or something like that. And so interpersonal, I feel like that's talking just as much about me trusting myself as much as you trusting me and I trusting you in a way. Is that right?
I like that. I like that interpretation a lot because I think in order to really build trust, you know, to have trust, there is an element of trusting yourself and being able to sit with yourself and sort of just be fundamentally with your own experience. And so that you when you're bringing that into relationship, that you can feel, okay, this person is hearing me, they're receiving me, And because of that, because there's enough space here for me to express, and I'm able to create enough space for this other person to express, then we can feel that there's this mutual reciprocity, and that's something like trust.
Mm.
That's something like, you know, for, you know, and it's not quid pro quo. It's not like I'll scratch your back if you scratch mine, right? Mm. It isn't. There isn't a power dynamic in it.
Mm.
To really have this interpersonal trust, you trust it. It's not about power. It's really clean and straightforward, and it's reliable.
Mm. So is it kind of like if I was in a meeting and somebody, or let's say I was in a meeting presenting a solution or what I believe to be a solution, and then somebody doesn't agree with that solution, which is natural in business. So somebody doesn't agree with that solution, and without me being on the defensive, to get to your point, I kind of trust them and I feel psychologically safe in that business to be able to be uncomfortable with being challenged, but trust that they're trying to get to the same solution as what I'm trying to get to. Is that right?
Totally. Yeah. Awesome. That's such a good example, right? And you can imagine how, because, I mean, I don't know about the environments that you've been in, but some of the environments that I've been in is that people are so often still trying to prove themselves, right? Mm. There's so much self-worth stuff going on, and that's part of why it becomes so personal at work, right? It's like, I'm going to try to put you down, your idea down, not because I think it's the wrong solution, but because I don't want you to get one up on me.
Mm.
You know, so I mean, this is really like this sort of stuff that it's a really, really, really real part of business, and of corporate culture, that like these are the sorts of reasons why we don't have trust. We don't have psychological safety because there's so much ego involved. The ego is clinging so much to what it thinks it needs, when actually in what you described is something that's, it's really beautiful in a way to say, I can deal with my own discomfort for a couple of minutes to hear a different idea, to hear a different perspective, because I know that we're both working towards the same ultimate goal. And it isn't about making myself look good or getting myself one up on someone else, but it's actually about doing good work.
Mm. Yeah. Do you know what? This is really difficult, because each time I could just have a conversation just on that one bit. But I really do want to move on. This is really difficult. So the next bit you've put on there is that kind of, you've said, which, so psychological safety and interpersonal trust requires active listening and empathy, which you have touched on already, but then you have right on the side, and it's not showing very well in my computer, but so correct me if I get this wrong. If you're lucky, the conversation, this includes, but rarely does it delve into how the preceding one related to the reliant on the preceding. Is that right?
Okay, maybe I'll read it. It's my handwriting. So okay, it says, if you're lucky, the conversation includes this active listening and empathy, but rarely does it delve into how the preceding are related to and reliant on the proceeding.
Ah, okay.
So I mean, so there's something interesting that is happening for me right now as I'm looking at this. And I'm going to do something really maybe weird. And I don't know if you consider this new agey, but and let's just say like very, very Buddhist or very something like that. Right. So my Buddhist teacher, his name is Dr. John Churchill. He's British. And I heard him give a talk a couple of days ago he's talking about basically the energy centers and the chakras, things like that. Right. And he's talking about basically like, sort of, I think like tantric physiology. Okay. So, and there's just something I like here about, there's something right that I'm doing right here in the model where I'm saying, this is a really vital bridge. between the stuff that came before that's a little more outside, a little more developed in a way, versus this stuff that's more, that's sort of deeper, more personal, more internal, more individual. Okay. So we're at this like bridge moment of active listening and empathy. So what I really, so sort of in like in the sort of spiritual circle, spiritual world, there, people talk about the heart chakra, the chakras, right? So you have most of the time people are using a model of seven chakras. And the seventh chakra, which is like, it's like the sort of most spiritual center. And that's like up above, right above your head. Right. Yeah. And then, there's the root chakra, which is at the base of your spine. That's considered the first chakra. People are, you know, there's this idea that we're trying to attain spiritual realization by going up the chakras. And if we work with this like seventh chakra, sort of this like soul place, then we're having these like spiritual attainments that are sort of moving up our body. And in doing state training and working with, in, with the physiology, with working, with energy, you can do practices where you're moving energy sort of up your body. So I'm going to tie this together. So, the thing that I think is really interesting that's, that, that is occurring to me is that my teacher, John, says, you know, it actually isn't like that. It isn't like the seventh is the ultimate. It's more like the heart is the center. The heart is the integrative function, and the heart integrates this, the sort of seventh, this like spiritual center, and it integrates this root, this deep root chakra center, which is this energy center that's like, it's really about safety, fundamental safety. And so it's more like a, if you look at it, if you look at it more horizontally instead of vertically, that the heart is integrating these high attainments and this aspiration, and it's integrating this deep need for safety, right? So I'm, for whatever reason, that's sort of what I'm seeing in the model right now as we look at it. Mm-hmm. So if we think about innovation and change as this really aspirational sort of ultimate thing that we're going towards, this, you know, innovation in a way is like, it, it, it can be like a spiritual expression. It can, it, it is sort of like an ultimate human expression, something moving through us that gives us this like aha, right? We don't really know how real innovation happens. It just sort of occurs, right? It's not linear. You can't plan it, right? It's just like, whoa, like I have an epiphany, right? It just happens. So if we, the corollary, right, is like, if that is sort of like the seventh chakra, right, this like spiritual center, and if what we need to start with is this like deep safety, this deep self-awareness, then the heart is the integrative function, which is really this active listening and empathy. So if you think about active listening and empathy, if you think about those as heart functions, as the way that we actually integrate our heart into the work that we're doing in the world. And let me just say sort of a, as a little anecdote, or I don't know what it is, but the heart, the research that's actually been done on the organ, the heart organ, is that the electric field of the heart, the physical heart, it extends in a very, very massive way. It's a huge field. So your physical organ emits a huge field that bathes all of your other organs. So if you're interested in this, there's the Heart Math Institute has done really, really interesting research on the heart. So the heart is this sort of function that bathes your experience in this integrative and sort of regulatory function. So I think the way that I wrote that sentence of like the preceding is predicated on the proceeding, it's like the empathy, you know, it's fundamentally empathy is like you're literally like opening, you're softening your experience so that you're like literally feeling what someone else is feeling. And one of the ways that you can develop that capacity is through listening. And I like the this metaphor of listening as like, it's like a bowl. And it's like, is the bowl empty? And is there a lot of space that you can fill with your, like right now you're giving me so much space. You're being so generous with your listening and you're just enabling me to continue to talk, even though I know you're there and you probably have things that you're thinking about and maybe that you want to say, but the sort of bowl, this like, there's this beautiful empty space in between us that I'm able to just fill. I can just fill the bowl up with my thoughts and with what I'm sharing with you right now.
Oh, your audio is just
because
gone.
You're.
Right. Say something.
And like, how ironic that like.
No, I was just about to say, as if that had just happened.
Yeah. Right.
No, I can hear you.
It's like I'm like tricking fate. Okay, did this go back now?
It went in and out. It's back now.
Okay, so funny that.
Yeah, how ironic is that?
Yeah, right? It's like there's a little synchronicity there, right? So it's like we're talking about how important listening is, right?
Mm.
And then the sound cuts in and out.
Yeah, I think normally I would cut that out, but I might leave that in because that's just so. I just thought. When it went, I was like, oh shit, she just said like how good it is that I'm not saying anything, but now I have to say something because the audience, it's dilemma. Okay, so you were saying about like kind of that bowl and that you were saying how you've got all that space to kind of fill it and that, and then it cut out at that point. So continue on.
Yeah.
It was good.
Yeah, well so you can feel when you're talking to someone and they don't really have a lot of time and space for you. They're not really listening to you. So it's like the bowl is full and like maybe you can pour a little bit into the surface, but there isn't a lot there there isn't really a container there for you. Mm-hmm. Right. So one of the ways that we can really develop our ability to listen actively and to develop empathy is really to like, to just be with our experience and be able to on our own calm our experience down. And just so it's literally like we're just opening our heart in a way that we can just receive.
Mm. When you said there that you can feel if somebody like doesn't want to listen or hasn't got the time, that is so true. Like one particular person came to my mind and I will not mention it in the podcast. However, that one particular person, I just know, like when they ask me a question, that it's a leading question to get to a point where they want to talk about something about themselves. And maybe that comes back to that thing you were saying earlier about it getting one up on someone and stuff like that. Maybe that's about maybe the same thing, but you're so right that you can just feel it, like that somebody, like you've asked me a question, but you don't give a shit about the response. Like you really don't care. And sometimes it's really obvious, isn't it? Like they'll interrupt you before you finished and you know, be like, oh, hi, Dara, what's it like in New York? Oh, blah, blah, blah. And you're like, God, you didn't even let me say. Sometimes it's so obvious, but sometimes when someone's talking, you just know that essentially they don't care, which is interesting.
Yeah.
Which kind of ties into that thing you were saying about it being forgive me, I'm probably going to butcher what you just said around like the chakras and stuff, but it makes sense that it's kind of more spiritual that, you know, I can feel when somebody just really doesn't want to hear the answer. They're just maybe being polite because they feel like they should. You can just feel that sometimes, which is interesting.
Yeah.
So you, have
to, you can.
Go on.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, so you have to try and build that into your business to be able to get your interpersonal, or no, I kind of got like the psychological safety and interpersonal trust was kind of like the room or the environment. We can kind of create that environment where we trust each other and we feel psychologically safe. But then the active, and I might be wrong, but the active listening and empathy is more me, like the, me, whereas the bits before were more us and them as a collective. Is that right?
Yeah. And it's more, I mean, I feel like we're sort of like co-creating, we're like interpreting this thing together because I made it a few years ago. So I really appreciate, you know, how you're sort of helping elucidate this alongside. And I think that Yeah, there's something about active listening and empathy that's really it's maybe really how you, it's really like your basis of operation or your sort of orientation to the other.
Okay.
So it's starting to turn into more of the personal. It's like, okay, how are you actually contributing to the interpersonal, the psychological safety and the interpersonal trust? So it's really okay. Sort of getting closer and closer to the individual.
I see what you mean. I'm with you.
Yeah.
So like I suppose actually your next bit down, you've got vulnerability. So maybe that maybe makes sense. And again, I could be completely wrong, but my vulnerability might be then affecting the environment of psychological safety because of how I'm acting. Is that kind of what you said?
Yeah. I mean, it's like if you're not vulnerable, your listening bowl is filled up because really to listen to someone requires some vulnerability to really soften and take someone in and really, one of my mentors, Rob, his name's Rob McNamara. He's awesome. He wrote a book called The Elegant Self. He says you have to place your attention inside of the person's voice. When you're listening, you have to literally place your attention inside of their voice. That's the depth of really what listening is. So you're literally like becoming enmeshed with what you're hearing.
Yeah. When you first said about like being listening is kind of vulnerable, my initial reaction was like, I'm not sure I get that. But then as I kind of think about it, and I kind of maybe try and relate it to this, to being a kind of podcaster, for lack of a better phrase, like there is a certain vulnerability in me letting you speak or me listening to you, especially somebody that is so intellectual in that one subject and me, the podcaster, is so not intellectual.
Yeah.
I have no idea where this conversation is going to go. And actually it may come to a point where I am vulnerable because I have no idea what to say next. And that's a kind of constant thing. And that's something I've struggled with doing this or the podcast is like, sometimes I'm listening to someone and I'm like, if you finish talking here, I have nothing to say. I'm like, where do I go with this? In the beginning, and my first, and we've not even been doing this a year, actually. I think we will nearly be at a year. I'll have to check my calendar. But when I first started doing it, I would panic and I would have to have my notes and stuff. And I've still got my notes, don't get me wrong. And I still check them. But I'm much more relaxed in that environment to be vulnerable, lead the conversation, talk to someone so intelligent as yourself, and then be able to just kind of go, is that like this or is that like this or have I got this completely wrong? So yeah, you're right, you do have to be vulnerable. I think
yeah,
great way to put it. So then your next bit you've put about self-awareness and self-reflection. Now self-awareness for me is something that I think I've only scratched the surface on it, but since finding out about it, I think has potentially changed my life. And I wouldn't say I've read any books about it or gonna be taught how to do it. Just the word self-awareness or the phrase self-awareness for me has helped me become self-aware. Like I'm quite aware. We had a psychologist on one of the, I think it was like the second guest we had on the podcast, and he was talking about it. And I kind of opened up to him a bit and said, like, I'm quite self-aware of the fact that I have a constant desire to be wanted and thanked and gratified, kind of like a dog, you get a treat all the time. I have a constant need for that. And he was saying, like, if you want to talk off the podcast, we can, because that's probably come from how you were raised and et cetera.
Yeah.
but ever since having that, I've been able to work so much better because I can say it's okay not to be thanked all the time and I don't need to be thanked all the time. It's a constant battle with that. And then the other thing, which I think everyone has, and we touched on earlier in the podcast, is that immediate feeling of being attacked when somebody challenges your way of presenting something or your idea or whatever. Being self-aware of those two things for me has helped me become a better professional, because essentially, as a lot of the time I might be saying, we can't do that because it's dangerous, in my opinion. And that's my initial reaction. But somebody inherently is going to challenge that, and I need to be okay with that. And that was just my real layman's kind of term and experience of self-awareness. Self-reflection is probably something I really don't understand, like how to reflect on myself. Is that just kind of thinking how I reacted in an environment? Is that simple, or how I reacted to you saying something? Or
I think the one of the best modes of self-reflection is journaling. And I think because it's something that I ask all of my clients to do, that sometimes people don't know how to journal. And it's like, in my understanding of what like a real sort of powerful form of journaling is that you sort of just sit down, and ideally your handwriting, because there is something physiological that goes on when you handwrite that like you get access to more stuff. But you just sort of like sit down, and you're not thinking and writing. You're not like, oh, what do I want to write about? Oh, I'm going to write about my day. Oh, I'm going to write about that conversation. It's more of an exploratory thing, because it's more like you use the journaling, you use self-reflective writing, journaling as, I used to just say like, I'm going to self-reflectively write. And then like my friends and my husband would be like, oh, you mean journal? Like, I don't know why I had to like make it anyway. So that's a funny joke. But yeah, you make it exploratory. You don't make it something that you know what you're going to say. You actually use it as a tool to uncover how you feel about something, or how you feel about a conversation you had, or how you feel about something that you're going to do next week. Like, you actually use it as an exploratory method for uncovering, revealing to yourself where you are with something, how you feel.
Okay. So that's interesting you said about journaling, because just before my honeymoon, I started journaling. It lasted about a week. I went on holiday, went on my honeymoon, didn't take my book with me, and it stopped. I think I would like to do it again. But you're kind of saying like you don't have a structure to it. And a bit of research I've done around it is like, some guy the other day I was watching said the best form was to just have three things that you were going to do in the day, and then reflect on how you did that and how you did it, why, and how you felt, etc. Then you're essentially saying just write. So how would you be able to put pen to paper? You know, where do you start? How do you feel about the day, or how do you feel about right now? Or
like, yeah. Yeah, so let me say a couple of things. One, again, this is like where my sort of like my deep love of emergence comes in again. And my desire to always sort of be in the depths of something, right? So I think using a framework like that is totally fine, and I think it's sort of a different thing.
Okay.
I'm talking more about this probably isn't the sort of thing that you're going to do every day. Maybe you won't even do it every week. Maybe you'll do it, I think, you know, once a week is really good, but maybe you're only going to do this sort of journaling. And the reason that I ask my clients to do it, because the nature of the work that I'm doing with people is that people are coming and they're sort of, they're in a, like at least a 6-month transformative container with me. So we're spending at least 6 months together working in a transformative way. So I'm hoping they have, you know, something to write about at least once a week for those 6 months. So, but it's like, it's a tool for when you're feeling, it's like maybe you notice that you're feeling a little off, or you're waking up and you're feeling grumpy, you know, a couple days in a row, and you're like, I don't know why, I'm just feeling grumpy, or you know, there's something that's going on in your experience where you feel a little off, or even you feel like really happy. Like there's something going on that you're feeling and you want to explore it. So you just sit down and you're saying, you know, you're right. You know, I'm feeling really blocked. You know, the block feels like, you know, it feels like this like weight on my chest, and it's like showing up at work. Like you just start writing about what you're experiencing.
So would it be more of a reactive process then? Like you were saying, like I've woke up, I would say over here, very typical, I woke up on the wrong side of the bed is kind of like how we would say it here. So I woke up in the wrong side of the bed, and I'd be like, okay, I acknowledge that feeling and I'm going to write about it. So is it more reflective, or not reflective, reactive then in a way?
Or that I think this might be a little more semantic, but like to me, literally what you're doing, like you, like in the example you just said, like you're literally reflecting on the feeling that you had about waking up on the wrong side of the bed. That's what you're reflecting on. Mm. Being reactive, or reactivity, or a reactive thing, it just has a different, and it might be cultural too. I mean, I spent almost 5 years in the UK, so I have a sense, but reactive has a different connotation. It's more, so in a very simple way, to enter into a reflective state, it has an openness. There's something really open about that state. Whereas to be in a reactive state, there's something much more narrow.
Mm.
Okay, I don't know if that translates.
Kind of, yeah. I get what you're saying. So would that, if you're, let's say we were to all listen to this and start journaling to that poor self-reflective writing, would that make us self-aware, or how do you become self-aware? So like I was saying, I feel like I've become a little bit more self-aware, but I wouldn't call myself someone who is self-aware. Does that make sense? Like, how do we focus quite heavily on self-reflection. Like, how does one become self-aware?
Yeah. So definitely doing this kind of exploratory journaling will definitely help. Can definitely help you become more self-aware, because that's literally what you're doing. You're like, you're trying to become more aware of why you're having the experience you're having.
Mm.
Fundamentally, mindfulness, meditation, being in any sort of like therapeutic or counseling, like didactic, where you're talking with someone, that definitely can help a lot for me. My background, my mother is an artist. I grew up like very in my senses. I was a dancer. My undergraduate degree is in mind body awareness. So I studied awareness techniques. So a really big way that I'm self-aware is kinesthetically. So I've really developed through like proprioception and interoception. I've really, really developed an ability to monitor and to be aware of what experience I'm having. Okay. like physically, and definitely you know, I think the work to deeply understand my emotional experience is like a lifelong thing.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so really being able to be aware of my physical state is a really, really big element for me.
How does somebody kind of like start with that? Because like I think we're kind of getting into an era where into a subject where in the UK especially, like I think maybe it's a generational thing. I feel like the younger generations coming up to like kind of like the new age would be more accepting to this kind of thing. But I think most of the people that I'm trying to influence, or CEOs might be trying to, or even CEOs themselves, are going to be of a certain age, of a certain generation,
that would be like, I ain't doing this soft ass crap, right? Touching his namby pamby bollocks or what, you know, they're coming up with some horrible term like that. But it's how, let's say I managed to influence somebody to get past the barrier that they don't think it's namby pamby. They think, okay, I'm gonna do it. And then they say, okay, James, you convinced me. What do I do now? You know, how does somebody start to be kind of self aware and I know it's not a simple answer. I know that.
It's not. But I'll try to make it simple that by saying more than what you do, even though you know, going to a yoga, let's just use yoga as an example. It's mainstream, it's secular, you know, a lot of people don't even know that it has like a spiritual basis. So yoga, you can, so even more than the what of what you're doing, even though the what can help, it's how you do something. So you can go to yoga, or you can go to CrossFit, or you can go, you know, run miles, whatever it is. And you can do it from a state of mind which is really goal oriented. I'm going to yoga to get fit, to make these shapes right with my body, and I'm going to strive until I can, you know, until I can make this particular shape. I'm going to work until I can be in down dog comfortably, until I can do warrior three without falling, you know. The how in that scenario is that you're striving. You're striving for an end goal. So you're not actually being present with your experience. You can do this. You can do all of those same things. You can run, you can swim, you can do yoga, you can do CrossFit, you can ski, whatever it is. But if you do it with the intentionality of being really present and really curious about your experience, you're going to have a totally different experience and probably a different outcome too. So you can sort of turn anything into an awareness exercise. And there are even awareness techniques that I work with. Namely, there's one that's called voice dialogue. It's also called big mind technique, where you're doing it conversationally. You're actually inviting people into different states, and then exploring what their experience is. But it's all about, you know, Are you gonna pay attention to what your experience is right now? That's all. I mean, self-awareness is ultimately you're aware of what your experience is, how you're showing up, how you're communicating. So starting really simply, when you're eating your next meal, are you just like shoving food in your mouth to like be like, I'm eating this meal? Or is it like, oh, I'm taking a bite, I'm tasting this, I'm paying attention to the textures, I'm looking at the colors of whatever I'm eating. Like, it's a really different.
That sounds very similar to mindfulness.
Is it? Yeah, like, that's basically what I'm doing. Okay. yeah. So
they're kind of one and the same, I suppose. Like self-awareness in that moment as to what self is doing, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah,
I like the dinner analogy, because I the amount of times I eat, so I eat so fast. The amount of times I eat something and I think, like, you know, I couldn't even tell you what it tastes like. I couldn't even tell you. And you think sometimes I just need to slow down and just chew.
Yeah,
Yeah, like you know, and the best analogy I think for me is a Snickers chocolate bar, and I'm very conscious this is probably one of the longest podcasts that we've done, but it's a great conversation, so I'm sorry to keep you. But sometimes I crave a Snickers chocolate bar. I just think I really want a Snickers, so I go and buy it. I've ate it by the time I get back to the car. It's gone. It's gone. And I'm like,
did you enjoy it?
I couldn't tell you. I think I just eat it. Like, I just eat it.
Yeah.
And then sometimes there's this thing I do. If I get some chocolate for me and the wife, right, I will not eat my chocolate until she eats hers, because I know once I've finished it, if she then starts eating hers, I'll have ate mine so quick that I'll be like, oh, I want some of hers now. Because because I've kind of not slowed down and tasted it. Maybe that's what you're saying. Like, it's not the fact I'm getting food envy because I finished it and I'm just a greedy bastard. It's actually the fact that I didn't experience the chocolate I was eating in the first place. Maybe.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I'm laughing because, you know, it's a little bit humorous the way we're talking about it, but it's actually like, if you think about that, like, but like sort of like expanded out into someone's entire life, it's quite devastating that we are so often not with ourselves. We're actually not in our lives. We're just not with our life, with our experience. It's sorry to sort of thread in this like dark note, but
no, it's true, isn't it?
You know,
you get a sense that it would fix so many of our problems that we're a bit more aware of ourselves, aware. So if I was a bit more mindful when I was eating that Snickers bar, I might not have a craving for so much longer because I've experienced it and I've got that enjoyment out of it. Maybe it would cure our obesity problem if we're a bit more mindful when we're eating, if we're a bit more mindful when we're eating about the impact of that on the environment or something. Maybe we would solve our environmental crisis as well. So I think you're right. I do think that it could solve so many of our problems. I'm absolutely fascinated by all of this. I mean, Russell Brand is massive over here, and he probably is over there as well. And he's really gone heavy into kind of the spirituality side of things, and actually meditating and doing all this stuff. And I've read his biography from when he was young and kind of his life and how horrendous it'd been to take somebody out of that environment to be able to put them where he is now is just phenomenal. So I'm kind of addicted to his podcast. You've finished this off and you've said like the self-awareness. So we've started innovation and change. You've got teamwork, collaboration, communication, psychological safety, interpersonal trust, active listening, empathy, vulnerability, self-awareness, self-reflection. And then you've said rich requires something that I'm not going to lie, I've never heard of. Developmental capability.
Yeah.
What is that?
So this is basically referring to adult developmental psychology. So the way that so basically the research in adult developmental psychology, the way that we develop as adults, it follows a particular sort of trajectory, a particular unfolding where different capacities come online at different stages of development. And the thing about adult development is that it isn't biologically driven like our early childhood development into adolescence. Like that's all biologically driven. It all happens biologically. Mm-hmm. So adult development is something that's very real and very possible for everyone, I think, but it's largely contextually based, and it's you know, it's like the environment that you're in, the people you're surrounded with, and your willingness to take risks, to be uncomfortable, to try new things, and to be reflective about it. So the way so depending on someone's sort of developmental, and I just want to say too that you know, this is a little more academic, but something happened with postmodernism where we, at least in sort of like the liberal sort of academic way, postmodernism became really suspect of hierarchy, of anything that said this is better than that, because postmodernism took the perspective that any hierarchy is oppressive. Mm-hmm. When actually a different point of view, and the point of view that adult developmental psychology takes, is that actually having something that is a growth hierarchy, not a dominator, not a depressive, an oppressive hierarchy, but a growth hierarchy, the way that we grow and develop as adults is actually, it's crucial. It's actually the way out of oppressive systems, oppressive cultures. So it gives us insight into where we can continue to develop our minds and our bodies in adulthood. So let me just give you a really concrete example. The one that I probably mention the most, and I think the one that we probably deal with the most inside of organizations, is the difference between someone who developmentally is at a place where they're orienting to an authority outside of themselves, whether or not they've internalized that and they're doing it to themselves, or they literally have a figure that they're like, that person knows the right way to do everything. There's a right and a wrong, you know, this very sort of black and white linear thinking, as opposed to someone who is orienting more from their internal sense of authority, an internal sense of what might need to happen, really different. And is sort of more independently functioning in that way. So I'm sort of loosely describing Robert Keegan's model. Mm-hmm. And that would be, the first one is more socialized mind, where you're functioning more in a social atmosphere. There's like an in, it's like you're either in or you're out. It's like us and them, mm-hmm. right? Or more self-authoring, where you're not following the path of the group anymore. You're actually going on your own path. Mm. So I think the model, it can function without this last step. I think it's really powerful even without this, but I think I included it because it's a little bit like the elephant in the room, okay. in that we actually have multiple levels of development functioning in a team, an environment, even within ourselves all the time. And it's really, it's something that we're not that aware of yet as a society, that actually there are different levels of development, and we can radically change our perspectives and our paradigms and our worldviews. And it's not just like we're stuck, and it's not like it's going to be us and them. It doesn't have to be that way for the rest of your life. But mm-hmm. you can imagine, if you're dealing with someone who is all about protecting the in-group at work, mm-hmm. versus someone who's willing to venture out and hear more diverse perspectives and mm-hmm. actually challenge the status quo, it's a really, really different function, like foundational way of operating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's where the kind of last bit you said there, that kind of brings it all into that real world perspective, that kind of like, this is my team. We are the health and safety team, for example. And as a hierarchical setup, we are the technical specialist. Well, that doesn't mean, like, when I'm delivering training and someone says, oh, this is a stupid question, I quite like to say 9 times out of 10, the stupid questions are the best questions, because it forces me as a trainer to really get down into something, to be able to make it simple, or it does something else. It makes me go, actually, no, that's a much better way of thinking about this or doing this or something like that. And it kind of reminds me of a book I'm reading at the moment by, what's his name? Matthew Syab, where he talks about diversity in thinking. And I think that's what kind of you, diversity of ideas and stuff like that, called rebel ideas. And he kind of put it into perspective and saying, there was this research done, and I've mentioned this in another podcast as well, but where a Japanese and American people were shown a fish tank. The American people saw mostly the fish when they were asked to describe it. They described the fish. Because of their culture, they were very contextual, very itemized in their way of looking at things. And the Japanese people were much more contextual. There we go. So they described the tank and the backgrounds and the sand and the plants, etc. And the point was that not one is better than the other. It's that if you only employ a Japanese team, you'll only ever see the fish tank. You'll never see the fish. If you and obviously he goes much more into this, but this is kind of my simpler way of putting it. If you employ the American team, you will only ever see the fish, never the tank. So if you were to combine the two, you would see the fish and the tank. Which when I read that, I remember sitting on my honeymoon reading that, and I just went, that's amazing. What way to kind of explain that, yes, I'm a health and safety team and I'm looking for a solution to a health and safety problem, but actually the finance manager might actually have a solution.
Totally.
But we never
totally. Oh my gosh.
Made me think of that's what I was thinking of when you were saying that kind of last line. Wow.
Awesome.
What a great conversation. First, I mean, that was a great conversation, and I could have quite easily spoke about every single one of them for hours on end. And I just kind of trying to think, to put it into perspective, maybe I'm a business owner, a business leader, and we'll finish off here. The bits at the top is maybe what me as a business can do, try to create a safe psychological environment, try to build trust within my business, work on how we're communicating and is that communication effective? Does everybody understand? Do we have good teamwork? Do we feel like we're working together as a team? Are we collaborating with other people to get those diversity ideas? Mm. And the rest of it to me seems very personal, like me as individual, for am I actively listening? You know, am I empathetic, self-aware, etc. How could a business, and I'm kind of do this in a nutshell because I'm conscious I'm taking up all of your day, could they put on a class, for example, on mindfulness and just say like every Thursday, at the last half hour of work, a voluntary session where Dara, for example, comes into work and does a mindfulness session or a meditation session or active listening session.
Sure.
Like that, would they make a difference? Would they help? Was that a silly question?
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I mean, I think that's great. The thing that I want to say is, you know, we spend so much of our lives at work. Mm-hmm. And so if you think about, if people want to start to work on these skills and these tools, work is sort of like, it's like the playground. It like is mm-hmm. the place where you're going to try to use these skills, you know, because it's just where we spend most of our time.
I like that.
I think there are ways, to culturally say, you know, we're going to try to invite more of these behaviors into our meetings, or we're going to have, I think something that's really, really simple that people can do is they can start to say, like managers can start to say, really, if managers have sort of developed these abilities, empathy, active listening, they're able to be vulnerable and open, and they can start to say, you know, what are the conversations that we aren't having, but that you go home and you complain about, or you vent about, or frustrating, or you think we need to be having as a team? Just starting there. What are the conversations that we aren't having that actually impact you and impact the work that you do and impact how you feel about work and being at work? And then the other thing that is more sort of this active listening technique. I mean, it's fascinating, you know, as a facilitator to just ask, you know, it's like you're in a meeting and you say, you know, Hey, Mary, can you just repeat what Steve just said? Or Mark, can you just repeat, you know, what Sam just said? So stuff like that, that's super, super simple, but it's a real skill set.
How do you do that from a perspective of not trying to catch people out? Do you know, like, I get what you're doing there, too. So you're trying to see if somebody is listening, like actively listening, but how can you do that without it being perceived as...
And maybe
that comes to the one of your top lines about communication is more how we say it. So correct me if I'm wrong, but it's not so much like, Dara, what did I just say? It's more like, hey, Dara, did you get that? Do you mind repeating what I just said? Or
yeah, exactly.
Is that like it? Or
I think so much of it is in how you say something. And the other thing is sort of the framing. So you can, if you're going to have a meeting, you can say, hey, I'd like to try something in this meeting. Can we just make sure that we're hearing each other so that we're coming to the same conclusions, that we're actually understanding each other. Mm. So, and maybe if you have a facilitator, that makes things even easier, even if it's, you know, if you're going to play the role of a facilitator in a meeting. I mean, you know, I think facilitators should just be like roving around organizations, helping people have conversations. But it's like, it's, you know, if you are light about it in yourself, you're like, hey, I want to do an experiment. Can we just try this? It might feel a little funny. I just want to check if we're really in sync with each other. So we're going to do this and we're going to make it sort of playful.
Would a simple first step would be leave your laptops at your desk? Leave your
yeah.
outside? Like,
totally.
The amount of times I go to a meeting and you're talking away and someone's like this. And you just think, I'm not even going to ask if you're listening, because how can you listen and type like that all the time? I don't get it. I can multitask, yeah, okay, but you may be listening and multitasking, but you're not hearing what I'm saying, and I don't think we're going to get a real good collaborative conversation if you've got your face in your laptop. Is that something that's, for me, that's it's a bit rude to start with.
I feel like it's rude too.
Yeah, I think maybe it's that empathy piece, you know, you're like, I've got loads of work to do. Yes, you're busy. We're all busy, but. Yeah. How is that being perceived as, to me, the presenter? I'm being asked to stand up here. Maybe I'm really nervous about that. And you're just sitting there on your laptop or your phone. And I just think, would that be a simple first step? That's something that tangibly a lot of businesses could do.
Totally. Totally.
Yeah.
That's easy. And, you know, if someone is that busy, then that, I think it's like, can that person be empowered in some way to make the decision for themselves, actually, you know, my time is better spent focusing on this than being in this meeting.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Cause that's the next question, isn't it? It'd be like, well, I can't afford to leave my laptop there. Well, then that forces us as a business to ask the question, is this meeting worthwhile?
Exactly.
And then we just get to a beautiful place where people stop inviting me in meetings.
Yeah, totally.
And I do think that's something that I'm really glad we kind of got to that. Just something that we can kind of tangibly take away, because we've talked about a hell of a lot of stuff, which I think, like you quite rightly said at the beginning, that we've gone a little bit in depth on these, but I think even now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we have just skimmed the surface again of a lot of this stuff. So, which kind of brings us a good way to kind of lead out. So we've scratched the surface of a lot of this stuff and someone are like, wow, I really like what Dara's doing and how you're talking, et cetera. You want to give us a quick kind of, give us an insight into what you could provide to any listeners that are out there, maybe in America or over here in England or wherever, that really interest you, your service you provide, how they could get hold of you. And obviously all the websites, links, LinkedIn, whatever, we'll put them in the description below.
Cool. Yeah, sure. Well, generally I'm sort of open to anyone, if anyone just wants to have a conversation or ask me a question, that's something I'm just open to generally. In terms of the work that I do, I work with leaders and I work with teams, and I also work with just individuals, people who want to develop themselves. Mm-hmm. So I do holistic life coaching and I do integral facilitation. Mm-hmm. And fundamentally, I help people, I help teams communicate better, I help teams have real communication, real conversations, develop actual relationship. As a quick sidebar, like, I don't think that there's enough genuine relating going on in the workplace. So I help people start to do that real relationship. And then, you know, I sort of help individuals find their truth, find their power, and orient their lives in that direction. So all of the work that I do is oriented to liberation and aliveness. We want people who are free, and we want people who are actually alive.
Mm. Yeah, that's a really nice way of saying it. I think, like,
you know, maybe somebody's listened to this and maybe we've gone down more the kind of personal focus, like how does this help a business? But like, if we could create an environment that is all of the things we've discussed and create people as comfortable and as safe, et cetera, of all of the things that we've discussed, what an amazingly, profoundly innovating and well-performing business as well. Surely that's just going to be an amazing environment that we would all, you know, wouldn't it be nice to not overly love your job? Like I always say, like, if you're a cleaner, for example, maybe you don't like being a cleaner. Maybe some people do, and that's fine. But most people, they think I'm just a cleaner, you know, and I say that in quotations. But it's like, okay, you maybe you're not going to be able to create the love that person might not have in the job. Like you would love your job. You've spent years, you know, working up to it. People like that inherently love their job, but a cleaner maybe not. Maybe we can create an environment where they love to work in so that they forget about the actual job, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Totally. So, you know,
go on.
Go ahead.
No, you go.
Well, you know, people leave jobs often. People leave managers. People leave the other people that they have to work with and the people who have power over them.
I agree.
So if you actually change those dynamics, you're going to have people maybe, you know, be a lot happier in what they're doing.
Mm. I agree. I think every job I've ever left is not too much the job or the business. It would be the leaders or the managers or one particular manager or whatever. So I agree.
Yeah.
100%.
Okay, guys, I hope you enjoyed that. I hope you found that conversation useful. I think Dara is that kind of person you could just talk to about this subject for hours. She obviously understands it to its nth degree as she's been studying it for so long. It's such a good conversation and it was really, really helpful for me, actually. And we actually recorded this a while ago and I'm still thinking about it now. So I hope you've enjoyed that, guys. If you did enjoy it, let's give it a share. Let's get Dara's voice into other people's ears. It's some really good eye-opening stuff in this podcast, and I think more business leaders, more safety professionals, business owners, etc., need to hear this message. So please, please, please share the podcast. If you enjoyed it as well, give us a rating or a review. If you do give us a review or a rating, just screenshot it and tweet us at Rebranded Safety, or come find us on Facebook as Rebranded Safety. And you can find me on LinkedIn, as our three people from the shout-outs did earlier. So my name is James McPherson, if you don't know already. Thanks for listening, guys. We've got a lot of big interviews coming up. As you know, we've got Andrew Sharman coming on the podcast, and that's being recorded this coming week commencing the 18th. And you've got an opportunity to ask Andrew a question. Check out my social medias. Check them out. LinkedIn, everything, wherever I am. I will have put a post absolutely everywhere to give you the opportunity to ask any question to the president of IOSH. It's probably one of the biggest names in safety at the moment. You know, here's your opportunity now to ask him whatever you want, whether it's what he has for breakfast in the morning, or what diploma he did, or how he exercises. It could be absolutely anything. I don't care. I won't, if we get loads, I won't ask them all, but I will ask the favorite ones. If we don't get too many, I'll ask as many as I can within our time frame. So make sure you go and check that out. If you can't find the post, just DM me to say, hey, here's my question for Andrew. So yeah, make sure you don't miss out on that. As we mentioned earlier in the intro, we've got Rachel coming back on, talk all about CDM. We've got some culture experts from America yet again come on in a couple of weeks. We've got some experts all that we're talking to about potential podcast episodes. So keep your ears and eyes peeled on Rebrand and Safety. We've got loads of stuff coming up. Anyway, that'll do for today. I'll catch you next week. Safe.